there. There's emptier spaces, so it feels cozier to sit closer. Okay? Okay, good. You have a problem. You can sit a bit there, but yeah. For the teacher, it's also that we have to look up if this is everybody is at back, but here. Okay. Then we are we ready to start? Okay, good morning, everyone. I think we are a bit behind of schedule. I try to be brief in my introduction. So it is my great pleasure on behalf of UVascular team to welcome you all to join summer school by Child Brain and Predictable. And the theme is life after PhD. However, there is, of course, I guess everything is preparing us for the life after PhD. But the topics are not only about transferable skills, there's also about language, neurocognitive disorders, open science, and then we have also topics related to, like, how to transfer science to practice. We have one, I guess you could end the, what is the company leader from First Beat coming also on one of the days. And many others. You have seen the program, so please take a look. And I guess I should say something about the weather first. it's inevitable. Yes, we admit that we try to arrange a bit chillier weather than we have had a heat wave of from 25 to 30 for the 3 weeks just for the summer school. But we made a bit of a mistake here. So, and the delivery man from above was not able to keep at the level we wished. So it just got a bit lower temperatures for you this week. Sorry about that. And today's news, I actually just read the headline, said, literally translated, heat wave coming handsomely back, but shivering in cold before that. So let's see how that will be. Today is about practicalities. This is today's program. So I will introduce you shortly, Barbara Höhle. And then we have a coffee break at 10:30. And you have been given tickets. You can use these tickets. We go and get the coffee from Pia to the cafeteria just close by. We have half an hour for that. And then we have open science part one, and later in the afternoon part two. And after the part one, Jarmo will tell you more practicalities related to summer school. So actually, before allowing Barbara to tell about Predictable and herself and have our keynote, I'll tell you a little bit about, for the Predictable people mainly, because Child Brain people mainly know about a Child Brain project. So you are just the comparable projects. So Child Brain, actually the whole name is Advancing Brain Research in Children's Development and Neurocognitive Disorders. And here are the people who are involved. And we have from all of these places now doctoral students. And they will actually present their work and themes in the poster session then tonight. So from UVascular, it's me, Jarmo, and Tiina Parviainen is sitting back there, if some of the Predictable people don't know. Tiina is also the leader of the Brain Research Center here in UVascular. And from Aston, we have Caroline Whittle and Joel Talcott. They are not with us here. And from Dunders, Radboud University, we have Robert Ostenveld is here, one of the speakers today. So he's a nice guy. You can talk about all statistics and data with him. Just be courageous. We have Jan Buitelar also now. He replaced Ole Jensen. Ole Jensen was supervising still one of our ESR work, doctoral dissertation. And from Coe Leuven, Jan Wouters, Paul Sesquier, and Maike, they are coming here, but they're not just yet here. And Carsten Wolters is from University of Münster. He will also appear tomorrow. And then we have three companies in this network. One is BESA doing mainly brain data analysis software. I guess most of you know this software. Harald Bornfleth and Mateusz Rusiniak from there. And Elekta, who has been also delivering our MEG equipment, Lauri Parkkonen and Jukka Nonen from there. They are not here either today. And Icometrics, Leuven from Belgium, Dirk Smets and Diana Sima. And then we have a number of partner organizations, Maureen Clerc from Research Center Sophia Antipolis, France, and Katani from King's College, London, and from Hungarian Academy of Sciences, Valeria Sepe and Ferenc Ombolukko, and then from the local Learning Disability Center, Nilomäki Institute, Juha-Matti Latvala, and this eye-tracking company, Topi, is also involved here with Ricardo Matos. Let's just have very quick, if I get my mouse to work. And here you see our web page. You can go and scroll yourself, but just to give faces to people. What? Oops. Then how to switch here? But this is the Windows 10 is new to me, so it does tricks. Let's see if we can do this. No? Did not help. Is it giving you now? No. Why they have made this so complicated? Is it showing up now? No. Okay, Braka is our guru in this, or at least he thinks so.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is it? Okay, better. Thank you.
Yes.
So, okay, just to give faces for people whom I mentioned here is, I don't go through the names again, but you can see them. And this is still would need a bit of updating like all web pages do. And here we have our child brain early stage researchers. You will also meet them in person more and you can discuss. So one of the purposes has been, of course, to, to intermingle and get predictable and child brain people to know each other, and also maybe think of this as an opportunity to meet, if you can, the PIs from the other project, and perhaps some of you find your place as a postdoc at some point if we have opportunities to hire postdocs. Okay. And now I should go back to my... Okay, good. So the objectives of the child brains have been, like in the predictable, to train new generation of interdisciplinary scientists who want to change science and renew it and create new sustainable and cross-disciplinary network of trained experts. This will be an important tool when you think of you will be the future science makers, and you will be networking with each other in the future quite a lot, so please keep this in mind. And our purpose has been also to develop some new analytical methods for brain imaging in children. And also we study actually also the brain development itself and neurodevelopmental disorders and try to employ their methods and try to understand the mechanisms better here. and also has been one important part to develop new commercial products, and this is mainly by the industrial partners and our ESRs who are involved there, and produce also open source solutions and disseminate, of course, then expertise that we produce for the general people, researchers, practitioners, educators, and so on. And here is just kind of in a graphical way how we were thinking about the project. So we have a bunch of science training in projects, and then part of this is also important, this training of transferable skills, and then these are supposed to be applied then to the end users as well. And we have three cornerstones in our project. Work package one is more the content related to childhood neurocognitive disorders. Then there's also a group and people studying brain development. And then we rely heavily on the work package three also, who has been developing methods for analysis and so on. And we try to integrate the work in all of these three work packages. But okay, I guess now we'll switch, and I allow Barbara Höhle to come and present Predictable and have a keynote. She's a professor of psycholinguistics and language acquisition at the University of Potsdam, and currently also, if I understood correctly, Dean of the Faculty of Human Sciences and Director of the Center of Applied Patholinguistics in the same university. And if you Google her website, you will see that she's been interested in languages, speech perception, and their development, auditory and prosodic processing, and a bunch of other things, as you can see from her numerous publications, what she has produced. So, Barbara, the floor is yours now.
The introduction?
Yeah.
Okay, does it work now? Yes. Okay, so
I guess we have to switch this off.
This was here, right?
Yeah, we have to. Let me see.
Set three.
Okay.
Yeah. So I have to stand a bit more in the back because I'm using my own computer. But there was a.
The pointer.
The pointer, right.
Yeah, let's see. This works.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, a few words. About Predictable. So Predictable basically is an acronym for understanding and predicting developmental language abilities and disorders in multilingual Europe, I think. There's missing something. And many things that Paavo has said about child brain is basically the same for Predictable, because there are some characteristics for this ITNs that basically hold across ITNs. So, for example, interdisciplinary training, connecting to areas outside of academia, to companies, in our case also, of course, to the educational and maybe also to the clinical area. So these are requirements that all these projects have to meet. So Predictable has... Oh, no, this doesn't work. Five partners and one... So the University of Potsdam is the coordinating institution of Predictable, and in Potsdam there are three researchers involved in training of the ESRs, that's Isabel Wartenburger, who's sitting over there, Aude Noiret, who is not here this morning, and me. And then we have as academic partners, of course, University of Jyväskylä with Paavo and Jarmo as the responsible researchers. We have University Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona with Nuria Sebastian Galés, who is sitting in the back, and Luca Bonatti, who is not here today, And we have University Paris Descartes with Judith Gavin and Thierry Nazi, who also are not here this morning. Then we have an partner from the private sector, the NIRCS, Medizintechnik, who's sitting in Berlin, in Germany, so very close to Potsdam. And this is a company who is involved in developing NIRCS machines, which is a technique that is used in some of the projects that our ESRs are doing. And probably you know that this NIRCS technology is very important, especially in the studies with very young children. So I think the group that constitutes this ITN is basically are people who, on one side, work on developmental disorders. This is, so to speak, one axis of our work. These are people who work with very young children, so infancy is one aspect of our research. And a third aspect is, of course, this development of technologies that can be used in research with very young children. So our ESRs are also very international, as basically also is required by these mobility conditions that these ITNs pose. So they come from France, from Spain, from the Netherlands, from Hungary, from Italy, from Tunisia, and from Colombia. And they basically are sitting on, mostly are sitting on the right side from my perspective. And as Paavo already said, I think you will meet at least in the afternoon during the poster session. And I think you have a lot of possibilities basically to network and to get together in the next days. So I mainly prepared some slides, two or three slides, about the scientific program of Predictable, because, as I said, most of these general conditions are the same as in child brain, and here are only some terms on this slide that we are interested in and that basically we want to work on in this network. So I think one important aspect is developmental risks, and we are basically looking on two sides of developmental risks, which probably are very closely related, namely developmental risk for spoken language, but also developmental risks for written language. So these are typically two age groups that we are considering there that are set quite far apart. So for the developmental spoken language risk, we really look at very young children. And of course, then for the written language, children are typically a bit older. Then, as I said, of course, understanding of normal, of typical development is a condition to understand these impairments better. So a lot of research that is done by the ESRs in Predictable also is related to language acquisition or written language development in typically developing children. And finally, as I already said, this development of tools that on one side can be used to study very, very young children, and with very, very young children, I really mean in an optimal way from birth on, or maybe even before. So this is one aspect. And the second question, of course, is how is there a possibility to identify children who are at risk for these developmental disorders at a very early age? And I think this is a very important question also from an applied perspective, because at least I'm not such an expert on written language development, but at least for development of spoken language, the general assumption is if we basically identify these children at a very early age, we may be able basically to provide them with some support such that they can go through these normal stages of language development that we see in typically developing children in the most similar way and in the most similar age ranges in which we see this development in typically developing children. And a crucial idea behind this is, of course, that many researchers in that area really believe in critical periods, that say, okay, there are windows in early childhood that are extremely important for language development. Okay, so this is what I wanted to say about predictable. And now I come to my more content-related presentation. But I have to switch the presentation before. Oops. Should go to the beginning. Okay. So those of you who checked the program carefully may notice that I changed my title slightly. So the contents will basically be the same, but I decided that phonological processing in impaired spoken and written language development covers that what I will tell you today a bit more closely. And I thought some of the students here, the Paris students, the Potsdam students, already know quite a lot of these contents that I typically present, and therefore I did a little bit of a different selection today. So you see that I put some parentheses around impaired. One reason for that is that I will also talk about typical development, and a second reason is that, and I will come back to that at really the final slide of my presentation, that we really don't know what is impaired, what is delayed, what is typical variation in all these processes that we see. So my presentation will basically have two larger parts. The first part is related to developmental language disorders, and here I mean spoken language development. And I will look at two aspects of that, namely one is prosodic information, which is basically a large part of my whole research, that I'm mainly interested in how does processing of prosodic information relate to very early language acquisition, and how does this prosodic development proceed in children that have risks for their language development. And the second is a more methodological aspect, namely, do these methods that we typically use behavioral methods, so I won't talk about brain at all in this presentation, are typical behavior measures that we use in studying very young children, can they basically be applied as some sort of diagnostic tool, what are the conditions for that, and so on. And in the part two, I will talk about one little study that we did about rhythmical processing, which is, of course, one aspect of prosodic processing in developmental dyslexia, and this is a study with adults. Okay, so I will start with a little comparison between specific language impairment, SLI, and developmental dyslexia, DD, just also to make clear why, in predictable, we thought it could be wise to study both kinds of disorders in a parallel way, or at least to have a group of students or ESRs work on these areas very closely together to see, okay, what are overlaps, where are differences, and so on. So if we just consider the typical description of these disorders, you will immediately see that there is a large overlap. So specific language impairment, the general definition may even be a term that is much too strong, is that specific language impairment is a development language delay or impairment without known cause. So this is a negative definition, so to speak. These children show a general cognitive development which is within the normal range. They have no hearing impairments, they don't have any brain damage, and they don't have social deprivation. And nevertheless, their language development is slow or impaired. Typically, these language impairments affect all linguistic domains, so phonology, syntax, lexicon, and so on. Children typically have problems in production and comprehension, But it's a very homogeneous performance pattern. So you children basically have different patterns of impairments in these domains. Some domains may be more strongly affected in one child and less in the other, and so on. There's huge research whether there are real clear clinical markers for this impairment. And obviously, one has to say, this depends on the language that the child is learning. So for English, one of the clinical markers that is discussed is verb finiteness, so that children with SLI have problems in acquiring the difference in the use of finite and non-finite verbs. In Romance languages, this seems to be not such a problem. Children use finite verbs in Romance languages from very early on. But in Romance languages, in Italian, for example, in Spanish, I think it's the same. Clitics, the use of clitical pronouns is a problem for these children. And I think this is an important point. So it's not one aspect of language that children have problems with, but it largely depends on the grammar of the language that the children are learning. So the prevalence, the numbers differ, but I think if we talk about 6 to 8% of children, then I think we are somehow at a number that is correct. What is also clear is that there is some genetic contribution to this impairment. So there is a family risk. Children who live in families in which affected members are present, siblings, parents, grandparents, have a larger risk of for this developmental language impairment as children that are not from families with risk. And there are studies that show that monozygotic twins have a higher concordance rate, so that both are affected, than dizygotic twins. For specific language impairment, it's generally assumed that the first clear indicator that a child is at risk is a behavioral indicator, namely that at 2 years of age, if the vocabulary, the productive vocabulary of the children, is not larger than 50 words, then one really should observe this child a bit more closely, because then it's the first indicator that the language development of this child is very, very slow. Okay, now if we come to developmental dyslexia. So developmental dyslexia is traditionally considered as a selective delay impairment in the acquisition of reading skills. And again, we basically have some sort of negative definitions. So these are children for whom the cognitive development should be within the norms, that have no hearing problems, no brain damage, no social deprivation. And I think traditionally it's also said that they should not have SLI. And I put that in parenthesis because we come back to that later, as we see a large overlap between these groups. So developmental dyslexia, it's clear. It impairs written language skills. Again, it seems to be very like SLI, somehow heterogeneous, so you have different performance patterns across children. There are effects of the writing system, so whether you have a very transparent orthography or less transparent orthography, that makes differences for the children, and so on. And the prevalence is around 3 to 10% of children suffer from developmental dyslexia. Again, there's a genetic contribution, like SLI, we have this family risk. Again, twin studies show higher concordance rates in monozygotic compared to dizygotic twins. And besides these really remarkable similarities in characteristics of impairments or delays in spoken and written language, there are many similarities, and in addition, there are large proportions or indications, let's say it a bit more carefully, that SLI and DD, that there are high coincidence rates of developmental disorders in both domains, so in written and spoken language. So a lot of studies show that a high percentage of children that have been diagnosed as having impairments in spoken language development in early ages and preschool ages show reading problems or problems in acquiring reading and writing skill when they enter school. On the other way, now many studies that looked at children with developmental dyslexia also have shown that children with developmental dyslexia have some problems, have some deficits in processing aspects of spoken language. So it's not obviously a problem that is totally selectively related to written language skills. But on the other hand, there are also cases where these two disorders are not associated. So you can find children with a selective impairment of either spoken language or written language. Now the question is, and some researchers have asked this question, is this comorbidity that we see between these two disorders, is it only a comorbidity that means, okay, we have children who have developmental disorders in spoken language and we have children who have developmental language disorders in written language, and we have also children who have both. But basically, there's nothing common in there. And of course, there are theories that would say, no, there is some sort of common source for both disorders. They are clearly related. And for this second assumption, there are two sub-assumptions, or how to say. So basically, the main idea is, and I think this is shared by many researchers now, that the connection between, or one of the connections between SLI and developmental dyslexia is in the phonological processing system, or in the phonological system itself that these children have. And here I have examples for two accounts in this area. Namely, one model that says, okay, it's a common source, it's phonological processing deficits that is underlying both impairments, and it's only a question of severity. Namely, that basically the SLI children are the more severely disturbed children, and that if you think about pure developmental dyslexia, that these may be children in which this phonological deficit is slight enough to not have been detected earlier. So these children have not been diagnosed earlier than children with a more severe problem. And then there is a model, I think a quite well-known model, meanwhile, by Bishop and Snowling, and they say, okay, we must be a bit more detailed in our assumptions, namely that there is only a partial overlap between developmental, between SLI and DD. And they say, okay, this phonological processing deficit is present in both types, but their idea is in developmental dyslexia, it's restricted, the problems are restricted to phonological processing, while in specific language impairment, there are additional problems. So the children have problems with syntax, with morphology, more maybe with their lexical development. But I think the main point here is that obviously there are many theories, many accounts that say, okay, it's a phonological processing that is shared by these two types of deficits. So there's a lot of research about the potential sources of this phonological deficit, and I think that most of these accounts would say, okay, it's a deficit that is present in the children from very, very early on, that probably is inborn, that children already bring to this task of language acquisition, and that hinders the acquisition of phonological information, the acquisition of the phonological system of the language from very, very early on. I think I will only mention, due to time reasons, these two most famous accounts, I think, in this area. and won't go into detail. So the two accounts that I want to mention is that one on one side, there is this assumption, there's a lot of evidence, I think, for that, that there's a deficit in the processing of short information or information that comes in a very, very fast manner. So this is the rapid auditory processing deficit account that was initially formulated by Talal already in the 70s of the last century. So a very, very old account, but still I think there is a lot of evidence that this is true, that children with SLI as well as children with developmental dyslexia have problems in these kinds of tasks where, for example, they have to discriminate tones that are presented with only very, very short gaps. So, and children who are at risk for these disorders, so there are even studies with children, I think, with 7 or 9 month olds, that from family risks that show that even at this young age, infants from family with cases of SLI or DD need basically larger gaps to be able to discriminate these sounds than children who are not coming from families with these risks. Another account that relates to these abilities of acoustic processing of information more is related to specific features of the signal, not necessarily to these temporal parameters as the account by Talal, but to specific features of the signal. And I want only to give you one example for that, because this is also important when we talk about the processing of prosodic information. So there's a lot of work from Goswami, but also from colleagues. Jarmo, for example, is very much involved in that, and Pavo, in this idea that rise time perception is a crucial aspect of... initially, I think it came from research from developmental disorders, developmental dyslexia, but now there are indications that children with SLI may have similar problems. So what is rise time perception? So rise time perception means basically the modulation of frequency in the signal, and this rise time, so frequency changes, so to speak. What is important about this rise time perception is that it's very closely related to rhythmical properties of language. So the rhythm, the change of stressed and unstressed syllables in languages is closely related by rise time, so by these rhythmical changes in frequency. I think Goswami initially really made this very strong claim that this perception of rise time is relevant for the perception of rhythmical structure of language, and also, and this is the consequence, so to speak, for speech segmentation. So we know that rhythmical properties, not in all languages, we come back to that, are very, very important for segmentation, so for segmentation of words in the input, for segmentation of syllables, and so on. And here the idea is that, okay, if children have problems in this rise time perception, they have problems in the perception of rhythmical properties of the language, and this, of course, causes, for example, lexical problems, because then these children have problems in segmenting words. It may also cause more restricted phonological problems because, for example, syllable segmentation is hindered, and then you won't find out specific phonological properties of your language if you have problems in, for example, segmenting syllables. Okay, so then the question, of course, that is connected to that, if this rise time perception deficit, which is really so to speak, if you look at it from the beginning, which is a very, very tiny acoustic property, or it seems to be like a tiny acoustic property, which is hard for the children to perceive, how should that end up in such a really profound problem like SLI or developmental dyslexia? This is the large question, and I think this is a question that I want to talk about now. So the question is, what is the function of prosody in a language, and what is the function of prosody in language acquisition? Remember that I said, okay, these children may have problems in this rise time deficit, a rise time perception, and this may lead to problems in segmenting, in perception of syllables, and so on. And as I said before, in the language acquisition research, at least in some areas of language acquisition research, it is assumed that prosodic information is a crucial information that children make use of in their language acquisition. And this account that makes this assumption is called the prosodic bootstrapping account. So what does prosodic bootstrapping mean? Prosodic bootstrapping means that children, very young children, use prosodic information from the speech that they hear, so from their speech input, to solve some crucial developmental tasks that they have during language acquisition. And these developmental tasks can be related to lexical acquisition, can be related to syntactic acquisition. So, and I come back to that in a minute. So there are basically three conditions that need to be fulfilled if a bootstrapping mechanism like this prosodic bootstrapping mechanism that I just described can successfully work. So one condition is that, in fact, that there must be some information in the signal, because the idea is, okay, the child hears the speech that is produced to the child or that is produced in his environment, and there must be something in the signal that the child can use for this bootstrapping mechanism. And this basically is fulfilled if we look at prosody, because now I think I have to go to the other side. Basically, this is what is in the signal, what is related to prosodic information, what from a linguistic perspective we would call prosodic information. So it's frequency, it's intensity, and it's duration of the signal. These are properties, acoustic properties of the speech signal, basically that relate to the prosodic system of a language. Then we have the perceptual system, so it's necessary that you are able as a hearer to perceive frequency, intensity, duration, also these changes, these modulations that I just talked about. So we perceive these frequency, for example, as pitch. Intensity is typically perceived as loudness, duration as length, but there are interactions between these parameters. But I don't want to go into detail. So this is a second condition, of course. So infants must really be able to perceive these parameters. Otherwise, they cannot make use of it. And the third point is, for this prosodic bootstrapping account, is there a systematic relation to the linguistic system of the language? Of course, prosody itself is part of the linguistic system, so if we go into the linguistic system, we talk about something like rhythm. So, as I said, somehow regular frequency changes are basically, on the linguistic perspective, they are considered as the rhythm of the language. We have something like intonation, so how are the frequency patterns across an utterance, across a sentence, and so on. We have something like stress in words. Is a word stressed on the first, or on the second, or on the third syllable? We have something like phrasing. So there are prosodic units in what you hear, and so on. So finally, and this is basically the important point now for us, is that there are systematic relations between the prosodic system of a language and its lexical and syntactic and also its semantic and pragmatic system. So just to give you an example for this relation to syntax, typically if we utter a sentence, then at the end of the sentence our voice goes down, we make a little pause, the frequency typically goes down. So this is what I meant when I said prosodic boundaries. So there are prosodic indicators in our language. Where are syntactic units? Where are boundaries of sentences? Where are boundaries within sentences for main and subordinate clauses and so on? So these are all marked by these kinds of prosodic features. And what does that mean? That means, okay, there is perceivable information, there are perceivable cues in the signal that the children hears that the child can use to make some sort of inferences, I call them now inferences, where are words, word boundaries in what I hear, where are sentence boundaries in what I hear, where are other boundaries of relevant units, phrases, and so on. So this is the basic idea of this prosodic bootstrapping account. Okay. Good. So for the middle side, so for the second question that I asked, we know from, this is basically something that linguistics or phonetician would investigate. So what kind of acoustic cues are in the input? And of course, then they also mainly asked about the relation here to the prosodic system. For this second part, namely the perception part, there's a lot of research now that shows that from very early on, infants are sensitive for these kinds of cues. So they can perceive even slight frequency differences, slight durational differences, slight intensity difference from very early on. So there's even research with newborn babies that show that infants can, for example, discriminate different languages based on different rhythmic properties. So they can discriminate French from English, for example. Newborns can discriminate sequences with and without these prosodic boundaries that I talked about. They can discriminate different stress patterns, so they can discriminate bisyllabic items that are either stressed on the first or on the second syllable. So this basically shows, okay, they can perceive these acoustic cues that are present in the signal from birth on, so to speak. So they are basically well prepared to make use of these correlations between input and prosodic system. This slide comes a bit too early. This prosodic bootstrapping account suggests, and this then again is quite important, I think, for this question of relations to language impairments. This prosodic bootstrapping account suggests continuous development. So when I talk about continuous development, I mean that basically the child can make use from this information from birth on, but, and that's the point, I come back to in a few slides, therefore I think the slide is a bit too early, but okay. Nevertheless, when the child acquires the prosodic system of the language, development is needed because languages are different with respect to their prosodic properties. And this is the old question, basically, that is asked in language development since years. So what is basically the contribution of these kinds of innate perceptual abilities that I just talked about and the specific properties of a prosodic system that a specific language has, and how do they then interact in further development? So when I talk about language-specific aspects of prosody, I think comparing, for example, Finnish to English or German makes it quite clear what I mean with these language-specific properties. So Finnish is a language that has word initial stress So each word has a stress on the first syllable. In German or in English, this is different. These languages are considered as trochaic languages, and that means that if you have bisyllabic items, they are, it's a bit similar like Finnish, they are stressed on the first syllable. But if you have three or four syllabic words, then the stress typically is not on the first syllable, but you try basically to form units in these words. So if you have, for example, a four-syllabic word in German, you typically have a secondary stress on the first syllable, and the main stress of the word is on the third syllable, but not on the first one. And this is really different from Finnish. And this is what I mean. Okay, these are, of course, language-specific properties. The child must learn what are these stress patterns in my language. but, and I want to argue for that, these prosodic development from being able to perceive these prosodic cues to establish this language-specific knowledge is a continuous process that we observe in already in early language development. And therefore, I think this prosodic development is a good area to look at early indicators for developmental language disorders. And I will give you now one example for this development. So there's a phenomenon that we call the trochaic bias in early childhood. And the trochaic bias means that it has been observed that in English, Dutch, and German learning children, there's a preference to listen to specific rhythmical patterns from very early on. And these preference for, or these specific rhythmical pattern that these young children prefer are exactly these patterns that I just talked about, namely when you have bisyllabic items, then the stress should be on the first syllable in languages like these three, so like English, Dutch, and German. And we have found in a number of experiments that German learning infants develop this preference so that they prefer to listen to this initially stressed bisyllabic words between the ages of 4 and 6 months. So at 6 months, these German learning infants listen longer, so to speak, to words that have the stress on the initial syllable, trochaic words, than to words that have a stress on the second syllable. These are iambic words. So we have also tested French learning infants together with our colleagues in Paris with exactly the same method, with exactly the same experiment. And these French learning infants did not show any preference. So they did not care basically whether these words were stressed on the first or on the second syllable. They showed the same listening times to both of them. And this, of course, again, is an indication that this trochaic bias is nothing that somehow is inborn in infants. You could also assume, okay, infants across all over the world find it more interesting to listen to bisyllabics that are stressed on the first syllable due to some sort of acoustic preference that could be there, totally language independent. But this difference between French and German children shows that this must be a result of language experience, of being exposed to some specific rhythmical patterns that the language that the children are exposed to have. And of course, it's important here to know that French is not a trochaic language. So French does not have lexical stress. If at all, French is more stressed on the final syllable of words, and only if these words occur in specific positions within a sentence. So therefore, we think that this emergence of this trochaic bias that we see in German children between 4 and 6 months is a clear indication, okay, the children have started to learn German because now they are somehow affected in their perception of the German language that they hear around them. And therefore we asked, okay, is this emergence of the trochaic bias, this preference for the trochaic bias, is this related to later language development? And this is a question that we try to answer in a longitudinal study that we conducted some years ago. And The basic idea in this longitudinal study, so this longitudinal study involved children from birth until preschool age, and some of these children were even followed after preschool into school age, also to look at their development of written language skills. So there were a lot of experiments that have been done with these children basically from birth on, but then regularly there were standard assessments conducted with these children on their language development, but also on their general cognitive development. So for language development, one example that I mention here only is the so-called set K, this 3 to 5, which is a German language standard assessment with different subtests. So there are two subtests that the authors really more relate to language capacities, which is sentence comprehension and a morphological rule test. And three other subtests that have a larger memory component, namely repetition of sentences, repetition of words, and repetition of non-words. And then also with 5 years, there was a non-verbal intelligence test that was conducted with these children, the so-called SONR. And I focus on these two standard assessments because they are relevant for us now. So we first tested these prosodic perception in the children from this longitudinal study when they were 5 months old with a behavioral paradigm that is called the head-turn preference procedure. And this head-turn preference procedure is really a classical method in infant research. So you put the baby somehow in a booth, and this booth is basically, inside the booth, there are only 3 lamps. There are red lamps on the side, so here, and basically also here on the other side, and there's a green light here on the front wall in the side direction of the baby. And the baby sits with his mother or father in the middle of this booth, and now what happens is their speech is presented only always from one side of these booths. So this is a loudspeaker outside of the booth, and on the other side on the wall, there's also a loudspeaker. And these lamps inside the booth basically are only attention attractors, so to have the gaze of the child basically focused on one direction at the beginning of each experimental trial. So the experimental trial starts with blinking of the green lamp here in the middle, and then typically the child looks at this green lamp, and when the child does this, one of the red lamps on the side starts to blink, and of course the child typically turns his head to this side and watches now this blinking lamp, and when the child did this, a speech stimulus started. And then what is measured is how long does the child turn his or her head in this direction of the lamp while speech is presented. And this measurement, so this time that the child spends to fixate the lamp while speech is presented, is called looking time or orientation time. So it depends. I think I have looking time on my slides. And what is important about this method is that these looking times, in fact, are modulated by the type of speech that is presented. So otherwise you could always say, okay, they are only looking at this blinking lamp. It does not tell us anything about what they hear. But there are clear correlations of these looking times to what is presented. So for example, to give you a very easy example, children have been found, and this was really one of the first experiments that has been done with this technique, that if you present infant-directed speech to the infant, so this speech style that typically is used to infants with much more frequency modulation and higher voice and something like that, that if you present speech like that, infants look longer, show longer orientation times than when you present typical adult-directed speech with flatter intonation and normal deeper voice and so on. So as said, this is an indication, okay, the looking times are modulated by the speech. Okay, so now what we did in this experiment, we initially presented the infants for 30 seconds only with trochaic patterns. So these were always bisyllabics, ga, ba. These were the only stimuli we used in this experiment. And then presented with a trochaic pattern, which then sounds like ga, ba, ga, ba, ga, ba, ga, ba. And then in the test phase of the experiment, we were presented with some trials that basically again had this prosodic pattern. So again, ga, ba, ga, ba, ga, ba. And other trials with the iambic stress pattern, which is something like gaba, 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 gaba. So based on your native language, you may hear the difference or not, or you may be better be able to hear this difference or not. But German learning infants are quite good in discriminating these patterns. So what we expected was, again, this preference for the trochaic pattern. Here, because I talked about 6 months before, we expected it even with younger children because they were basically, they listened to this pattern already before in the experiment, which is different from the other experiments that we did before. So now with the same infants, let's first look at what the infants did. Whoops, wrong direction. So this is only the results of this study with when the infants were 5 months old. So the blue bars are the listening times for the trochaic pattern. The red ones are the listening time for the iambic pattern. And if you only look at this group, so these are 37 children that came from families with no risk for developmental language disorders, and you see this clear effect. So they listen longer to the trochaic than to the iambic items. Now here are 11 children from risk family, and what is really interesting, even though, of course, this is a small number, here you don't see anything. So just keep that in mind. So what we did was we basically looked at the results. These are the same children when they were 5 years old. And we formed two groups based on a median split. And this is the median split according to these two language tests, sentence comprehension and morphological rules of the ZK tests that we applied when the children were 5 years. And you see clearly the children who are above median in this language assessment, these are again the data from this experiment at 5 months. So this trochaic versus iambic listening times. And you see again that the children who are above median at 5 years showed this clear trochaic preference when they were 5 months old, while the children below median in this language assessment didn't. So this is a retrospective data analysis. We went back to this old data based on the language performance that the children showed at 5 years. Now, for the other subtests, which were more related to memory, this median split did not show differences in the performance. So what is interesting about that, it really seems to be quite, this relation seems to be quite specific for the central linguistic capacities that are necessary in sentence comprehension and this morphological rule generation. Okay, so our time is running a bit fast, so I will jump over some of the slides, I think. So I think what these results show that there are relations between this early prosodic processing and the more higher linguistic skills, so to speak, that the children show at the age of 5 years. So this is interesting because, as I said, these are earliest indicators that we have that children are starting to learn their language. So in languages like German, we can find these earliest indicators, so to speak, in prosodic processing. What we don't know, and I think there's really some more research needed, is this a specific problem that the children have with prosodic information? That could be one reason. Is it the perception of prosodic information that delays them, so to speak, in this acquisition process, or, and this could be a second explanation, basically they don't have problem in perceiving this prosodic information, which based on the Goswami account may not be so plausible, but one could also assume that it's a general learning problem that the children already have at that age, namely that they are just slow in finding out what are specific properties of the language that I'm learning. So these are basically still two separate hypotheses that one could use to explain this relation that we see. Okay, so I jump to one study that has been conducted within the Predictable Consortium that relates to this point that I talked about. Can we use these kinds of methods like the Hatter and Preference procedure as some sort of measurement that can be applied to very young infants to find some indications, is this child at risk for developmental language disorders or not? And the problem with all of these measures that we have to study very young children is that they are basically considered that the data basically can only be considered or analyzed at a group level. So there's so much variation in these kinds of data that you basically cannot decide for a single child, is this a child that shows basically typical development or that shows this difference between trochaic and iambic pattern that I talked about or not. So for a single child, basically, this cannot be decided. There are not so many items in these experiments. They are short and so on. There's a huge variation. But, of course, if these kinds of methods are to be used in some sort of diagnostic tools, they must show at least some signs of reliability. Do we really reliable measure some capacities that the child has with these kinds of measures? And there are several criteria for reliability, for validity. Do these test what we want to test with them around? That should be considered. So if we want to measure individual variability with these kinds of measures, we need large enough variance in our measures. There are different kinds of reliability measures, so you can do split half reliability, so does the first half of your task measure the same or does show the same output? The second half, which is also, again, not very applicable for these kinds of tasks because typically we have something like 10 to 12 items, so does it make sense to split them? But another option, and this is what we tried, or Mireya tried in her work in Predictable, is there any test-retest reliability? So if we just do the same test twice or several times with the same child, are the results compatible or not? Do the results go into the same direction? So does the same child show a preference, for example, for the trochaic items across several testing sessions? Or not. And basically this is what was done in this study. So Mireya did a repetition of these spontaneous preference experiment to trochaic and iambic items. So the children were only exposed to trials in which trochaic items appeared and to trials in which iambic items appeared without this familiarization phase in three different test sessions. So the same children basically were involved here, and the distance between these test sessions should have been around 1 week. Of course, you always have a little bit of variation. You cannot be so strict with infants to really keep that. So, and the children basically, the youngest one were just 6 months old, and then at the third session, the oldest ones were just 7 months, of course, old. And then when the children were 1 year, a German questionnaire on their vocabulary was done, so it's comparable to the English CDI. Now, but the main question is, and I will focus on that, do we really see any stability across these sessions in the individual children? And first, let's just look to the, at the correlations, not at the general results. So what came out is that these are two different tables. These basically are the raw listening times across the three sessions and especially the correlations across the three sessions. And you see, these are the listening times to the trochaic items, and you see that they correlate basically in all three sessions quite nice, but not for the iambic items. So for the iambic items, we only saw a correlation between the second and the third session. So the children who showed long times in the second session also showed long time in the third session and vice versa. Now, a second measurement is a difference score. So what is the difference between the orientation times between trochaic and iambic items? And there you see an almost significant correlation, again, between the second and third session. So at least between the second and third session, the correlations of the performance between the children are quite high. We also found some indications for correlations with these ELFRA, with these CDI-like parents questionnaire, and again for the second session. So this you can don't have to look at that. This is a later test with also a parents questionnaire. But again, we see okay, there are some correlations between the the performance in this experiment in the second session and the later language development. So what I want to say, there is some hope that also these behavioral measures that may be quite or maybe somehow stable across different points of measurement, and this means, okay, there is some sort of reliability that it's not only basically noise or something that goes into these measurements, but there is a little bit of stability in there. So, finally, I think I'm almost done. So, what was 10:30, right? Huh?
It's 10:30.
Okay. Then I just present you two final slides, and I don't come to the dyslexia study again because I promised that to the French ESRs. But okay, next time, because I want to say one interesting thing, I want to add one interesting findings, which I think is relevant, but which I would like to say a few words about. So. There's a study by Schad, Hesse, and Friederizi, which was published in, I can't even read that myself, can you read it? 2015, I think. And what they did, so first of all, these are data from the same longitudinal study that I talked about before, so from this GLED study, where we tested this trochaic bias in 5-month-olds and looked at their language performance at 5 years old. So in the study, so first of all, I think everybody basically knows that there's an unequal distribution in developmental language disorders. So boys are typically have a higher risk of these kinds of disorders. At least I know it for spoken language, but I think it's for reading it's the same. So this is basically long-standing observation. And there is already earlier research that shows that hormone levels, hormone status, has some correlations to language development. So there is a study by Lutschmeier, 2002, that showed that testosterone level predicts vocabulary size at 18 and 24 months. And obviously there was knowledge before, didn't know that before, that there is some sort of mini puberty, as it's called. So there are high levels of sex hormones in infants between the ages 2 and 4 months. So basically, obviously, it seems to be as high as in the real puberty, that is something around 12 and 13 months. And what Schad and colleagues then basically asked is, whether this hormone concentration during this mini puberty, and especially these sex hormones, so male testosterone and more female estradiol, predicts later language performance. And as I said, basically they tested the same. We don't know exactly so far what the overlap is, but at least they used the same language assessment that we used, or so to speak, it's basically the same data for the children that overlap. But I just only wanted to show this to you because you see in general this is a comparison boys and girls in these language subtests of this language, of this ZCAR, and they don't basically, if you do a group split according to sex, there are no statistic significant differences. So this is, I think, important. Boys and girls are not different in these tasks. But if they basically consider these hormone levels, and I think these measures were also taken when the children were between 4 and 5 months old, so at a time that basically corresponds to our prosodic experiment. And I don't know whether you can really see that. So this is testosterone level at 4 months and sentence comprehension performance at 4 years. And this is estradiol level at 4 to 5 months and sentence comprehension at 4 years. And you see here there's a negative correlation, meaning the higher the testosterone level, the worse the children were in the sentence comprehension at 4 years, and the other way around for estradiol. And this also came out in the statistical analysis. So what does that tell us? There's a correlation. This can be seen. But I think, and these are, I think, my last words that I want to say, there may be biological markers for, maybe the biological markers is even too strong. So there are biological relations, of course, to language acquisition. There are behavioral indicators, as in our experiment, that allow for some sort of prediction. How does language performance in some area, in some linguistic areas, may look like at 5 years? But the question then is, what does it mean for, and I think you can think about that as well, can we use these kinds of markers as early indicators for identifying children with risk for developmental language disorders? So on one side, I think one would always say, okay, if these hormone levels are really reliable predictors, then nothing is easier basically than doing that, because you would not even need blood. So this was based on blood samples. You would not even need that today. So every child with 4 to 5 months, if you basically determine the hormone level of this child, you would know, okay, is this child somehow a risk child or not? On the other hand, I think that, first of all, and I think this relates to both, this relates to these behavioral markers as well as to these biological markers. One has to keep in mind that in both of these studies at the end, we did not have a diagnosis for SLI or not SLI. So this, what we saw was basically some sort of distribution of variation in this language assessment, and that there's a correlation in the variation basically in the language assessment and in the variation of the hormone level. So this means that we don't have any selective markers for SLI, for specific language impairment here. So this is important. And then I think a second point that one really should keep in mind is, even if we find, for example, hormone markers that really reliable would predict, okay, this child is a child that really will have a specific language impairment when it's 5, what does it help us? So I think we need this behavioral data in addition to really clear ideas how does language development proceed? Because only if we know, so for example, if we know that for a German child, the use of prosodic information is really important, and that this problem that the children have is related or has negative effects on the processing of information of prosody, then of course an early intervention should somehow focus exactly on that. Namely, it should support the child by making it basically better able to use this prosodic information. And of course, this is only knowledge that we can gain from behavioral studies, from studies that where we really see, okay, how do children respond to specific kind of linguistic information in the input. And of course, hormone markers would never tell us that. They could somehow say, okay, maybe this is a child at risk, but I think for all kinds of interventions, we really need this behavioral knowledge. Okay, thank you. That's it.